Well, thank you for this rare opportunity to speak to such a prominent audience of physicists. I used to be a physicist, or mathematical physicist, some time ago. So this talk is motivated by recent development that's combined very old subject in statistical mechanics, Danner models in two-dimensional statistical mechanics, which are also known in mathematics as perfect matchings on graphs, and topological string theory. That was somewhat surprising merge. So really, so there are two aspects in the modern state of art of these developments. One is Danner models and statistical mechanics aspects of this, and the other is topological string theory and what sort of is growing up mathematically out of this. So I'll focus, in this talk, I'll focus on the aspects of statistical mechanics. And at the end, I'll mention the recent developments in the topological string theory, say. So what are dimers? Suppose you have a bipartite graph. Bipartite graph means that you have two types of vertices, say black and white, and the rule is that there are edges only between white and black vertices. Now, for some reasons, for the future talk, I will assume that this graph is planar, and I will assume that it's really planar in the sense that it's embedded on a plane. It's not embedded on a Riemann surface, although you can do this as well. So dimers on such graph is just a way to color edges, say, or just to separate it into two subsets, thick and thin, and thick edges will be dimers. And the rule is that dimers should never meet. But every vertex should be boundary of a dimer. In combinatorics, this is a very well-known subject, and it's called perfect matching. So you have a graph with this bipartite structure, and you want to match vertices connected by edges. So every dimer configuration is a matching in this sense. So if you have a pair of dimer configurations, then if you just take the composition of such configurations, you see that every such pair will be equivalent to a collection of closed loops on your graph. And each of the loops, or just a pair of dimer configurations. One dimer configuration is red, the other is green. Each of these red and green. Yeah, you can have loops with zero area. So you can naturally orient every loop like this. Say you can orient first dimer configuration going from black to white, and second dimer configuration going in the opposite direction. This gives you orientation of loops. And since you know which one is first, which one is second, you know which one is black, which one is white, so you don't have the ambiguity. So you can think of pairs of dimer configurations as non-intersecting, non-self-intersecting, dense loop configurations on the graph. And that's a planar graph, and we'll assume that the plane is oriented, so everything is nicely oriented in this case.
And vice versa?
Vice versa, well, you should have the bipartite structure, and I suppose so, yes. Yes, if you have, the only problem is that loops should have even length. Every such configuration of loops of even length, it can be considered as a pair of dimer configurations.
There's more than one way, actually, because disconnected loops, you can switch the red and green.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't think about it, so it's actually not essential, I think. It's important in one direction. Mm-hmm. Okay, now the next important object for these dimer configurations is the height function. To define the height function, we should fix a base dimer configuration, any dimer configuration D0. Fix a base point on the graph. More precisely, it's a point on the dual graph. So it's a point in the face of this planar graph. And then we define the relative height function for every dimer configuration D. It's a function on the faces of your planar graph. And it's defined in this way. The function at the origin, at this base point, is 0. And then every time you go across the oriented line, which is the one of the lines of this loop configuration corresponding to the pair of dimer configurations, the height function gains 1. So if you think of this height function in terms of this loop configurations, this is the function for which this loop configuration is the set of level curves. So once you have such height function, it's clear that it defines a discrete surface that is hanging over the planar graph. And random dimers correspond to random surfaces. If you're averaging over dimers, it's the same as averaging over these random surfaces. Okay, so that's the height function.
So when you say average over, what's the weight function?
With some probabilistic distribution. I didn't specify any. It's a question about what you're averaging.
It is a very small class of discrete surfaces.
It's a very small class of discrete surfaces.
Natural order.
Yeah, exactly. It's the class of surfaces that project nicely to this planar graph. So now, how to assign probabilities to such surfaces? Well, let's weight dimers in the following way. First, we'll fix the system of weights, W. So this will be just the function on edges with non-negative values. So to every edge E, we assign a non-negative number, WE, which is the Boltzmann weight corresponding to the dimer sitting on this edge. Let's also fix a number between 0 and 1. And let's define the weight of a dimer configuration D as the product over all dimers in this configuration, the weight of the corresponding edge times the Q to the sum of the height functions. And this sum of the height functions is nothing but the volume under this discrete surface. So somehow the notion of the height function and this weight gives the three-dimensional flavor to the problem. If you don't have this, well, you still have the three-dimensional flavor, but then the weight distribution wouldn't see. I should say that it's not necessary to take Q to the volume. You can consider also inhomogeneous weighting, so you can weight every point individually with some weight Q sub x. Now the partition function, as always, is the sum of all dimer configurations on our graph, the weight of this dimer configuration. And of course, the probabilistic meaning of the weight is that the probability is proportional to W, and Z is the normalization factor in this probabilistic measure. So, okay, so this is the formulation of certain model of statistical mechanics. And
are you going to motivate the model anymore?
Yeah, just a sec. I'll explain what it means in more conventional terms. Just class of natural correlation functions first, before going to the motivation and to the solution to the problem. So let's consider the characteristic functions of dimers. So this function is the function on all dimer configurations. On a given dimer configuration D, it takes the value 1 if the edge E is in D, and 0 if not. So then the sort of basic correlation functions in the model are just averaging of the products of these functions. Now, these dimer models, they were studied by Kastelein in the 60s and by Fisher and by many others simply as models of statistical mechanics where you can actually compute the partition function and see the critical indices and so on and so forth. So there is more modern kind of exposition of all these methods. It can be found in the papers by Cooperberg and Kenyon. So essentially what I'm doing here is the sort of more modern version of the solution. So there are two motivations. First, an obvious motivation. It's a model of statistical mechanics that can be solved, and you can do whatever you can do in this case in order to compute partition function and correlation functions. Second motivation is that it's actually it's a free fermionic system. So if you want to study fermions on discrete surfaces, this is the way to do it. Say if Q equals 1, let's consider the simplest case. The partition function for dimers can be represented as a determinant of certain matrix. So I'm defining the matrix, and the sort of statement about this matrix will be that the determinant of this matrix will be equal to the partition function of dimers. And that's why it can be computed, because in some cases you can actually compute the determinant as the product of the eigenvalues. So so let's enumerate vertices, black and white vertices from 1 to n, and let's define the matrix, so-called Kastelein matrix, which is either, so its matrix elements is either 0 or the weight of the edge Eij if these two vertices I and j are connected by an edge. Up to a sign, there is also a certain sign involved. So the choice of this sign is effectively certain, it's a representation of the fundamental group of the graph in Z2. So more precisely, it's related to this. More precisely, it's the following. Of course, it's defined up to certain gauge transformation, up to sigma I sigma j inverse. And here is the definition. So first, let's include the outside of gamma into one planar graph on a sphere. So the outside, assuming that we compactify at infinity on the sphere, is certain n gone. This n is even. And then it's a simple topological analysis with the earlier characteristic to see that the total number of, you see, our graph is bipartite. So every face has even number of edges at the boundary. This even number can be either 4n or 4n plus 2. So the total number of 4n gons is even if your graph is on the surface, on the sphere. It's, again, as I said, it's a simple exercise with the Euler characteristic of the sphere. So because the total number of four n-gons is even, let's choose a matching between these four n-gons. Since the number is even, we can do it. Connect matched four n-gons by paths. Well, choose these paths in such a way that they intersect only edges. They don't go through vertices. Then these signs can be chosen in this way. It's minus 1 to the number of paths through this edge Eij, number of these matching paths. Why this is so, don't ask me now. but the nice fact is that you can also do it on any surface of genus G with any number of boundary components. And if
so
the...
If I just think of a rectangular cubic square lattice, and I could choose a matching to all the diagrams this way, have one sign and more than one.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
simple.
Yeah, that's what Castellan did. So the partition function for the planar graph is simply the determinant of this matrix, and of course the correlation functions are simply the following. Because it's a free fermionics, well, I said this, but I didn't prove this. It's a statement. You can actually compute it, and this correlation function is equal to the determinant where the entries are matrix elements of the inverse Castellan matrix. And this is essentially why you can think of the system as the system of free fermions on this discrete graph. Now, if your graph is on the surface of...
What do you mean by thinking of it as free fermions?
Precisely meaning this, that you can... that the partition function is equal to the... You have black and white vertices. You assign psi star to black vertex, psi to white vertex. You take this integral. And then the correlation function is simply the expectation value of this. OK, so if your fermions live on the surface or with some boundary components, then it's slightly more complicated. This is not just the determinants, but this is a sum of certain determinants with different choices of sign matrix and with some sign. Say, for example, if you consider the torus, this will be the sum of four determinants, and this is a well-known fact. Say, when you compute the partition function on the Ising model on the torus, you have four possible boundary conditions, and you have to take into account all of them. So
you've introduced this fermions just to rewrite the partition function being a determinant.
No, so far it's just a remark. I never need this. I'm just saying that if you want to think about
this is still q equals one.
This is still q equals one. If q is not equal to one, the partition, the Castellan matrix can be modified slightly, and it's the same stuff. It's the determinant and the correlation functions are determinants of the inverse Castellan matrix, and now the Castellan matrix will depend on Q. So, with Q or without Q, it's a free fermionic system. So this is what. So this is the summary of this. So geometrically, you can think of this planar graph gamma plus the choice of weight system as a disk with the Riemannian metric on it. The Riemannian metric is given by this weight W. If you just think about, if you just look at the Castellan matrix, you will see that it is either 0 or WE. So you can think of this W as the length of the edge E. And if you think about it in this way, then this matrix K becomes the kind of lattice analog of the D-bar operator. And the D-bar operator in two dimensions, it's just the Dirac operator. So this is the discrete Dirac operator. And so you can think of perfect matchings as fermions on this domain with the Dirac operator D-bar. So that's sort of that's the quantum field theory sort of way to think about these dimer models in statistical mechanics. From now on, let's focus on the special case when the graph is a honeycomb lattice. All the weights are equal to 1. So that means, geometrically, it means that it's a graph embedded into the plane in such a way that the length of each of the edge is 1. And fix some q between 0 and 1. So this is a typical configuration of dimers on a hexagonal lattice. So black edges are dimers, red edges are non-occupied dimers. It's just a remark about this particular hexagonal lattice is that the complement to dimers, you can see it clearly on this picture. These are, the loops on the graph, which are non-intersecting, non-self-intersecting, and fully packed, so that there are no edges not covered by these loops. This is a, this is a feature of hexagonal lattice. It doesn't have to be this way. On other graphs, it's not this. So, okay, this is this is a dimer picture. And now let's look at the dual graph. So let's look at the graph with the vertices at the centers of hexagons. And we will omit some edges. If you'll just consider the hexagonal lattice and the dual graph to the hexagonal lattice, it will be triangular lattice. But we omit those edges which would intersect dimers. So it's not complete triangular lattice. It's just a sort of subset of this lattice. So let's look at the result. So this is what we have. And it will be more transparent what we have if I'll slightly rotate the picture. If I'll rotate it like this. So then you see the corner of the room with walls and with the floor and with some boxes piled in the corner. So this is another way, this is a specific, this is the way specific to hexagonal lattice that dimer configurations on hexagonal lattice can be thought as this three-dimensional things, the sort of piles of cubes in the corner. Or in mathematical language, this is called plane partition. I will give precise definition of this later on. So, okay, so now this is what we will study. We will study the planar partitions with the, we will study these piles of cubes in the corner. And the partition function is, it was the sum over all dimer configurations, q to the total volume under the discrete surface defined by a dimer configuration. And in these three-dimensional terms, let me return to this picture. Oops. Now I have to rotate it correctly. Okay. Now, what is the height function in this picture? It's the following. Let's consider the family of planes which are orthogonal to the vector with coordinates 1, 1, 1. So that's the vector that is sticking out from this screen perpendicular. So let's consider the planes that are parallel to this. So the height function in this case, say the height of this vertex, is simply the height of this vertex in this 1, 1, 1 direction. And In order to have the height function, I have to choose some dimer configuration d0. You remember that I defined a relative height function for the pair of dimer configurations, d and d0. So in this particular case, the d0 dimer configuration will be simply the empty room. So when you have rhombi arranged in this way, so this is the dimer configuration d0 on the hexagonal lattice. So
what does that correspond to?
That's so these are the dimers. And the hexagonal lattice is hidden here. So you see there are three equivalent ways to think about these configurations. First, dimers on the hexagonal lattice. Second, this three-dimensional picture. And the third one is just the projection of this three-dimensional picture on a plane. It gives you a tiling of a plane by rhombi. By rhombi is of two types. Rotated rhombi is by, I guess it's 60 degrees. And horizontal rhombi. So the sum of the dimer configurations with this weight is the same as the sum over this 3D Young diagrams or 3D partitions q to the number of boxes in the partition. This weight, well, I didn't write it here, d0 and x0, but it's clear that, so as explained, d0 is this configuration, and this is x0.
These are called 3D Young diagrams because they have projections on the Young diagrams and many of them.
Yeah, exactly. If you have such pile, every slice of this pile in this direction or in this direction or in any of these directions is a Young diagram. So it's this for this reason it's called 3D Young diagram. So the correlation functions, well, one more remark. If you have such configuration, you can see that it's completely determined by the positions of the horizontal rhombi. If you forget about anything else, if you will just remember sort of minimal information that you need to reconstruct this picture is the position of horizontal rhombi. So if you want to have the information about these random surfaces, it is enough to have the correlation functions of horizontal rhombi. And so this is what we will study.
These are sometimes used as models of crystal growth.
Yes, exactly. That's because you have
overhangs.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll mention this, but this is sort of how you can think of this. This is a crystal growing from the corner. Or if you reverse the picture, this will be the melting of the crystal. If you will think about this as the inside of the crystal, this will be the melting of the crystal that goes from the corner.
But dimers were also used to model some disordered systems, strongly correlated electron systems.
Yeah. It's a model that you can give many interpretations. Of course, the characteristic feature of the model is that it's solvable in some sense.
Yes.
And then you can apply it whatever you want.
Then you find an application.
Yeah. Okay, so these are the correlation functions that we will study. The product of these characteristic functions are weighted with the q to the number of boxes. And these are more or less the same correlation functions that I mentioned before. All right, so now some pictures. So here is a... So you see what I didn't say? I didn't say anything about the actual shape of this region. At the beginning, I said that it's a planar graph, but sort of by saying that we have a corner in the room, I neglected so far what happens outside of this corner. And of course, there are several possibilities. Either you have some finite complicated configuration, or some finite simple configuration, or your room is infinite, and then you have to set some boundary conditions on the asymptotical distributions of dimers. So here is an example of tiling of a finite region with the hexagonal shape. In terms of this three-dimensional picture, you have to think about it in this way. This is the room that sort of the parts of the room that you can see, the edges of the room that you can see are green ones. The ones that you cannot see are blue ones. And this is the floor. Everything below the blue line is the floor. Then here you can see the line separating the pile from the wall. The same here, you can see the line separating the pile from the wall. And then these regions are the regions, this are the regions where the pile actually touches the roof and these sides of the room. And then another feature that you can see here, that it looks like if you consider this distribution of piles of cubes with q equals 1, it looks like as the size of the room will grow, there will be most probable configuration of cubes such that everything that is outside of this circle will be frozen. So here it will be an empty wall, here it will be a piece of empty wall, here it will be pieces of the pile, here it will be a piece of the floor configuration. And inside you may expect some smooth distribution of cubes. So perhaps this room is too small to see this effect, but if you will do the computer experiments, and there are nice old
algorithms. This is generated by a random, just a...
Yeah, there is a nice algorithm that generates these configurations. And this algorithm is so-called loop erasing algorithm. Basically, it generates the most probable configuration of such tilings, say, going from this direction to here. I don't know. I can explain this, the idea of this algorithm later. But if I'll do it now, there will be no time for left. Here's another example. The same type of thing, but now for q less than 1. So here you can see that clearly that asymptotically for a large room, you have some kind of limit shape. So, okay, these are the sort of experimental results. But of course, the history of this is the following. First, there was a theorem that there is actually a limit shape. Using certain variational principle, you can prove that there will be a limit shape which will be smooth inside and will have some boundary curve. Then using this is, well, think about this as the infinite room. It's just that because of the computer experiment, the room was cut off by the finite size.
For q less than
1, yeah. So it has been proven first by mathematician Gershik that for q less than 1, you have this asymptotical shape. Then it was proven by Cerf and Kenyon. Not proven, but actually this asymptotical shape was computed using certain variational principle. And then in our paper with Okunkov, we computed it using sort of exact solution that essentially based on the fact that it's a free fermionic system. So So this was, so now what happens if the if we have an infinite hexagonal lattice? So then the easiest way to set boundary conditions is to say that just the room is infinite, and that means that the dimers are going like this in all directions. More complicated way to do it is to say that, say, the room has complicated system of corners, and in each of the horizontal directions there are these systems of couches, you can say. And so if you set up these boundary conditions, and in terms of dimers, it means that when you change the direction, the asymptotical directions, the sort of orientation of dimers changes as it is shown here. So if you look at this picture, it's clear that there are three partitions involved in this boundary condition. And the partition function of dimers with these boundary conditions will be exactly the topological vertex that was studied by Waffle and his co-authors. Okay, so now one more remark about this system. It's the melting of crystals, as you mentioned, as or formation of crystals. So if you want to interpret this system in this way, then Q is e to the minus susceptibility divided by the temperature. Susceptibility is sort of the energy of the individual, of the formation of the individual piece of crystal. And the rule is that this piece sticks into the existing pile of the crystal only if three edges interact. So if two edges only interact or one edge interact, the interaction is not enough sort of to keep it there. And if you don't have four edges available from the very beginning, then you will never have them by simple topological reasoning. So that's the growth rule. Okay, so then I keep mentioning plane partitions. So here's the precise definition of what it is. Just maybe first I have to start with the line partition. Say, what is a partition? Partition is when you divide something into something. So when you have an integer, non-negative integer, you can always represent it as a sum of non-negative integers. You can permute them, so you can naturally order them lambda 1 greater than lambda 2 and so on. And so this is something like a line partition because they are ordered on the line. Plane partition is when you represent n as the sum of entries a1 plus a2 plus b1 plus b2 plus c1 plus c2. And you write these entries in the corner of the quadrant of a plane in such a way that the entries are non-increasing when you go from left to right, and they are non-increasing when you go from top to bottom. So this is what is called plane partition. So when you have this pile of cubes, just the heights of the of each sort of one-dimensional sub-pile is the entry of the corresponding plane partition. So here's the correspondence. Now, we fixed one distinguished direction, and say, in order not to have ambiguities.
But it would be a plane partition, a valid plane partition in any.
Yeah, yeah. So, as with this plane partition, you can do all sorts of reflections of the partition in the Young diagram. So here, if you have this plane partition, you can. It also encodes three other plane partitions. That's right. So.
Two of them.
Yeah. So. Altogether, there are three. What should I say? Yes, few words about terminology, because I think now it's getting a little bit confusing. These piles are used to be called 3D Young diagrams. This is a long name, so somehow the tradition, modern tradition, is to shorten it and to call this 3D partition. 3D partition meaning that we just partition the space into two parts. One is inside of the pile, the other is outside of the pile. So 3D partition is the same as a plane partition, and it's the same as 3D Young diagram.
Is there a generalization, by the way, of all this across the higher
dimensions? You can generalize it, but there is nothing useful is known about these generalizations. A remarkable fact about plane partitions is that you see the usual partitions, these are characters, well, they are related to the characters of the Virasoro algebra and to all these cube sort of partition functions. The nice fact about plane partitions that if you will take the algebra, this W1 plus infinity algebra, which is essentially, so I keep writing here.
There is an eraser here.
Uh-huh. Thank you. If you will take W1 plus infinity algebra, which is more or less the following. You take the universal enveloping algebra of GLN hat and set n to the infinity. Then at least some of the irreducible representations, or some of the very simple simplest irreducible representations of W1 plus infinity are exactly the partition functions that I'm talking about. So the coefficients, it just, there is a Virasoro sitting inside of it, so what you do is just you take trace of Q to the L0. And the coefficients in this power series are exactly the number of plane partitions. For if you will take the so-called vacuum representation, then it's exactly the statement. This trace is equal to the partition function for the number of plane partitions. So it is equal to sum over n greater or equal than 0. Q to the n, and then the number of plane partitions of n. This can be, well, there is a paper by Frenkel, Edward Frenkel, Katz, and they have several papers. This one, I think, is in this one, Radl and one. So, okay, so this is mostly about terminology.
Is this W1 plus infinity the one that has a contraction to the group of area perceiving?
Yeah, that's the one. Okay, now the phenomenon of limit shape. You already saw from the pictures that as this as the number of cubes in piles becomes larger and larger, then the most probable configuration of this pile have a tendency to converge to some limit shape. So here's what is known about hexagonal, restricted hexagonal lattice. Consider now a hexagon with sides A, B, and C. For the time being, let's choose the weights to be 1, Danner weights, and let's choose Q to be 1. So then our partition function is simply the number of tilings of this hexagon by these three types of rhombi. Or in other words, if I want to use the three-dimensional picture, I'll say that this is a room of the size A, B, and C, and then I pile cubes in the corner of this room, in the green corner of this room. So then the number of such thing, so this will be exactly the number of plane partitions. So another interpretation of this number is that Z is equal to the number of plane partitions of the restricted to the size, say, B and C, and each entry of the plane partition restricted to the way that it's does, it cannot be larger than A. Okay, so the number, this number has been computed. It's a remarkable number. It's this, it's its finite product. And it was computed by McMahon in 1915 in his book Combinatorial Analysis. published at Cambridge University Press. So the it's not obvious that it's an integer, but it is an integer. So now let's consider the, well, we want to investigate what happens if the size of the room grows. Actually, this first example of the hexagon with lots of cubes in it was an example of this one. So now let's consider the limit when a, b, c goes to the infinity in such a way that the ratio is kept finite. So if we want to see what happens with the sort of expected configuration of these cubes of rhombus, what we have to do is we have to compute the asymptotics of the correlation function of the expectation value of this characteristic function sigma ht. And here is the theorem. So here's the result of the computation that was done by Cohn, Larson, and Prop in 95, and then was redone by Cohn, Canyon, and Prop using different methods. So it turns out that this, well, there is a nice geometrical fact that probably goes back to Pythagoras or someone like this, that in such hexagon, you can inscribe exactly one ellipse. And so then once you inscribe this ellipse, let's say that these red things will be the wall parts. This will be the floor part. And then the asymptotics of the, this is also floor, and this is floor. So the asymptotics is the following. This density is 0 on the walls. It's 1 on the floor and on the roof. And it is some smooth function inside of the ellipse. So you have this nice limit shape. And the way how they computed it, it's remarkable. They didn't give any reference to computations in matrix models, but what they did is more or less exactly the same variational principle that you use when you compute the integral over Hermitian matrices. Then you assume that the eigenvalues sort of form the limit distribution with the continuous measure rho t dt, and then for the function rho, you have singular integral equation, and you solve it.
What is the matrix here that's from
the
K?
Pardon?
What is the matrix that's coming in here?
What is the matrix? Oh, you mean what is the matrix integral? There is no matrix integral. Here, what you have is the following. You have the, say, let's look at closely at the pile of cubes. So if you have an empty room, so let's say that this is a room, your pile is somewhere here. Let's do the vertical cross section in this direction. So then everywhere below a certain point, you will have horizontal dimers. You will have horizontal rhombus. Then at some point, you will start to see the pile. So some of the rhombus that otherwise would be on the floor will be bumped up higher. And you will have positions of these rhombus, d1, d2, d3, d4, with the obvious inequality like this. So I don't want to go into the details of this, but this is the precise discrete analog of the eigenvalues of Hermitian matrices. So what you have here is, in some sense, the sum over the discrete, kind of over the integer eigenvalues of something that is supposedly a random matrix. And if you just look at this paper, it's difficult to see the analogy, but sort of eventually, sort of after 1 hour of staring, and you see that there is nothing there except this singular integral equation. But it's a very nice sort of calculation. And okay.
It is rho.
No, you know, I'm skipping the computational details. I can tell you later what rho is. It's some function that will take, you know, it's approximately this and this. It's some quadratic form that has lots of alphas, lots of betas, but the meaning is, its explicit form doesn't reveal anything.
Well, it's
quadratic. It's quadratic, yeah. Yeah, that's the important part. Okay, so now let's consider the case, the dimers on this infinite hexagonal lattice. Again, I assume that all weights are 1, Q is between 0 and 1, and then the partition function is just the partition function for the number of plane partitions, and it has been computed by the same McMahon in the same book. Now, the limit shape was first computed by Cerf and Kenyon using the variational principle.
How did he get that?
Hmm?
How did he do this?
It was an enumerative proof. So basically, he, you know, when you have a function, the proof by bijection. This is one of the definitions of combinatorics, is that if you want to prove that one thing is equal to the other, then combinatorialists would do it like this. They would represent one thing as sum over something, the other thing as sum over something, and then they would construct the bijection between the terms. So, you know this formula, and then you just take the infinite product of this. So you have to take the infinite product of this, and then you just count the monomials, and then he established the bijection between the coefficients, between individual terms in this decomposition. Yeah, you raise it to the nth power, use the not binomial, but whatever nomial formula is, and it's not completely easy proof, but it's very, it's rather transparent sort of bijective proof. Now, the modern proof of this that we did sort of as an exercise uses vertex operators. And it's a very simple one. So the idea of the new proof is that first you prove that the partition function is equal to the product of the usual vertex operators that you use in bosonic strings. And then here is the usual vacuum of the bosonic string, which is annihilated by the action of V minus. And V plus and V minus are chiral parts of the vertex operators. So V plus Z, well, V minus W is equal to, I probably will get all the signs wrong, so, but that's the idea. So first statement is this one. To prove this statement, you should use the formula for the matrix elements of vertex operators in terms of Schur functions. That's something like this. I don't want to go into too much details, but that's the formula. So V plus is the exponent of integral, well, depends on what you call phi plus Z. So it's just the positive modes of the Bose field, phi, and then you use the fermionic representation of this. So this is essentially psi star Z, psi Z, normal ordering, positive part of it. Well, this is well-known fact that they commute in this way. It's also well-known fact that if you will take Fock representation of these fermions, then the basis can be parameterized by partitions. Well, for this you just sort of take the Frobenius coordinates of the partition and then use and apply this to the vacuum, and this will give you V lambda. And then the matrix element of the vertex operator V plus X is equal to this. And in order to see that this partition function is equal to this matrix element, you have to use another combinatorial representation of plane partitions. As the system of interlacing Young diagrams. So when you have a plane partition, then you can slice it in this way. And every slice will be a Young diagram for the reasons that I actually explained. Because every time you construct the pile, you bump up some of the horizontal rhombus up. And then interlacing diagrams, you will have, well, because I will explain it to anyone who wants to know this. So that's the vertex proof of this formula. Now, this really, so there is some representation theory of GL infinity and vertex operators sort of hidden inside of all this. And this is why you have the analogy with the matrix models, and this is why many other things happens. I'm already going over time, so I'll sort of speed up to say a few words. So now, so far I was talking about trivially weighted dimers when the weights are just one. You can assume that you still have the infinite hexagonal lattice, but you have some weights that are periodic with respect to the some sublattice. So then you have so-called periodically weighted graphs, and they also have limit shapes, and these are something more complicated. They are related to amoebas and to beautiful things in real algebraic geometry, but this is for mathematicians. This is not for...
Amoeba is a mathematical term, not a biological term.
What? Amoeba now is a mathematical term. It's, you know, I'm sure you will keep hearing this in all aspects. For example, there is an interesting idea that actually the mirror symmetry has kind of simple combinatorial counterpart. It's just the symmetry between a so-called asymptotical families of Calabi-Yau manifolds. So imagine that you have a family of Calabi-Yau manifolds when the volume is growing. Then you can parameterize these families by certain combinatorial data, sort of about how this manifold sort of roughly speaking look at the infinity, and then you can identify certain families, and that's the mirror, supposedly mirror symmetry that doesn't involve neither symplectic nor complex structure, just mirror symmetry between Riemannian manifolds. Now, in this analysis, in this asymptotical analysis, you will see amoebas everywhere. So probably that you will hear about amoebas sort of several times at least. And amoeba is, I can give a definition, it's a very simple thing. Imagine a curve. So it's a complex curve given by a polynomial equation. Then amoeba of this curve is a system of curves in R2 are given by the map C to R2, which does this. It maps the point xy of the curve to the point s, which is the logarithm of the absolute value of x, and t, which is the logarithm of the absolute value of y. The image of C under this map is called amoeba. And here is an example. If you will take the curve x plus y is equal to 1, what is the amoeba of this curve? Well, it consists of three pieces, three connected components. One connected component is this one. The other connected component is this one. And the third connected component is this one. And that's exactly the asymptotic shape of the dimers. And that's a general fact. Amoebas of certain curves are always asymptotic shapes of certain dimer configurations. From the point of view of statistical mechanics, it's a rather remarkable situation. It's the system where lots of phases are separated by certain space curves. So for example, when you go from this region to this region, you sort of pass through the phase transition point. It's not that when you increase the temperature. So, well, the other remark that I wanted to make, now, can I go over time for a few minutes? So the other remark is, say, if you consider the hexagonal lattice still trivially weighted, just as I studied before, you will have the sort of asymptotic shape of more complicated configuration, and sometimes it can develop these spikes. For example, in this case, more complicated boundary condition means that once when you increase the size of the partition, you also change the boundary condition accordingly, so that this Young diagram also go to the infinity. Yeah, you choose the Young diagram, this Young diagram corresponding to this boundary condition, and then you consider the limit when q goes to 1. That's when these limit shapes appear. In this limit, larger and larger plane partitions contribute to the partition function, so dominate the partition function. And eventually, sort of the asymptotically, this one will dominate. This will be the limit shape. If the size of this partition increases as q goes to 1. So maybe just to illustrate the analogy with matrix models, the only thing that I have time for is, say, when you will study correlation functions, then you will see that in the bulk you will always have the sine kernel, that is one-time correlation functions. By one-time correlation functions, I mean the correlation functions of rhombi that are on the same vertical line. That would be exactly the analogs of this spacing distribution. So if it's the edge, then it's area distribution, exactly as in matrix models. But here there is something nice. It's not area, it's not sine kernel, but it's Peirce kernel. It's the one that you have in the diffraction, where instead of integrating e to the x cubed, you integrate e to the x to the fourth. That corresponds to sort of more complicated critical point. So then there is a question sort of whether there are other critical points here that you can investigate. That's still something to think about. So now, finally, the relation with topological strings. So if you consider this partition function, it will depend on three boundary conditions, lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3. The experimental fact is that it coincides with the Gromov-Witten invariant for C3 with, this topological vertex, as Kumran called it. And this Gromov-Witten invariant is the following. You take C3, in it you take three Lagrangian subspaces, and you map surfaces of genus G into here such that the boundary goes to one of these three Lagrangian subvarieties, and the degrees of this map for the first one will be lambda 1, for the second one will be lambda 2, and for the third one will be lambda 3. So that's the geometrical origin of these partitions. So Kumulon computed the Gromov-Eaton invariant, and then it turns out that one can prove that this partition function is exactly equal to this invariant. So this was the state of the affair in September. Then in the recent paper, Iqbal, Nekrasov, Okunkov, and Waffa, they sort of elaborated this idea and sort of made it more precise. But then the real breakthrough is in the third paper, which was just published. This is the paper by Molik, Nekrasov, Okunkov, and Pandaripande. And that's the very nice observation that connects two types of invariants, Gromov-Eaton invariant and so-called Donaldson-Thomas invariant. So the first one is well known. So what you do is you take the exponent of this partition function f, that's usually called, which is the generating function for the number of classes of maps of Riemann surface to x, such that you fix genus g, and the image is supposed to represent the class beta in H2 of x. Now, the Donaldson-Thomas invariant is a similar but different thing. So I don't want to give, I mean, it's a separate, like a two-hour talk to introduce all the notations. But the idea is the following. You use the same idea, but the numbers n here are not these integrals, but it's the number of ideals in the, roughly speaking, in the algebra of functions on x. Ideals vanishing on some subvariety y, and then chi, this n is the earlier characteristic of the structure sheaf of this subvariety. And beta, again, the second integer, second cohomology class. Now, Donaldson and Thomas, they introduced this invariance, but probably they didn't quite know what to do with them, since there were no there were no development in this since 1999 when they introduced them. But it's a relatively recent stuff. Yeah, that was the problem. So now the conjecture. So that's the conjecture from this paper that I mentioned, the last paper. That if you will take the Gromov-Witten invariant for x, it is equal to the Donaldson-Thomas invariant for the q equals minus e to the I u. So, of course, you can always rewrite this function of u as a formal power series in u in terms of formal power series in, say, e to the I u minus 1. But the non-trivial fact here is that the coefficients of this thing is integers and have some special topological meaning. So, second, conjecture is the conjecture about the normalization factor. Remember that I introduced this normalized Donaldson-Thomas invariant as a ratio of two things. So that this is the denominator of the ratio. That it's always equal to this McMahon function Q, which is the infinite product, semi-infinite product, to the power topological Euler characteristic of X. And the third conjecture is that the coefficients of this normalized invariant are invariant with respect to q to the minus q to the q inverse. But this is probably the this is definitely the most remarkable conjecture. And what is remarkable is they proved it for not quite Calabi-Yau manifolds, but still for those manifolds where you can define both Gromov-Eaton and Donaldson-Thomas. For the toric varieties that the projectivization of this. You take the canonical bundle over the surface, take the structural sheaf over the surface, take the sum, projectivize it, and then assume that it's also toric variety for three-dimensional torus acting unit. So this one is three-dimensional because this is three, this is one, and you projectivize, gives three back. So so this is quite remarkable, and I just want to put one more analogy between this and something else, which is probably related, but I don't think anybody knows how. So if you will take this identity and look in sort of nearby whether there is something similar, there is actually something similar. If you will take Chern-Simons invariant, it depends on the level k. If you will do perturbation theory, you can expand it in 1 over k. Coefficients are perturbative invariants of links and whatever. So this is one thing. Then you also know that the same Chern-Simons invariant is the Jones polynomial in case when you have a knot in S3. And it's a polynomial in Q with integer coefficients. And the coefficients of this polynomial, they also have nice topological interpretation. There is a series of papers by Havanov, Frenkel Havanov, and sort of his sort of the permanently occurring author, and then there are several combinations, where there is a topological interpretation of these coefficients. And this identity is actually quite reminiscent to this identity. You have one invariant, which is sort of power series in 1 over k, the other invariant, which is the actually polynomial in Q, and again with the same symmetry Q to Q inverse. So I think maybe this is the beginning of something nice. Okay. Thank you. That's all.
Is it something that you only define for non-compact Calabi-Yau's, or for any Calabi-Yau? If I give you the Calabi-Yau, you can tell me it's amoeba is this. It's not exactly a toric base of the Calabi-Yau. What?
No, there are papers. Well, if you will have the family of Calabi-Yau's with the increasing volume, then the asymptotical metric of these families of Calabi-Yau's can be expressed in terms of more general amoebas. This is the two-dimensional amoeba. This amoeba is the base. I mean, this amoeba that I draw is the base for the toric Calabi-Yau.
But it's two-dimensional.
Well, the one that's two-dimensional, meaning it's in R2.
Yeah.
You can have more general amoebas. You don't have to consider a curve. You can consider any algebraic variety, affine algebraic variety, and then this will be give you an amoeba in Rn.
Calabi-Yau's in quasi crystals paper.
Mm-hmm.
I thought these were three dimensional Calabi-Yau manifolds, and is it two dimensional boundary between
quarter of the remaining? No, amoeba is the.
What's the whole?
No, you see, that's the. Okay. This is the amoeba, this thing, the boundary curves. Now, there's, of course, the surface that is inside. This surface is given by so-called Ronkin function. That's the, say, amoeba is, well, let's say, I introduced these coordinates as t already. So the Ronkin function is the following. You take 1 over 2 pi squared, and then you average over the product of two tori the logarithm of p of e to the s plus I phi e to the t plus I psi d phi. And then if you want to define this limit surface, that has coordinates, roughly speaking, these ones. In the appropriate change of x, y, z coordinates, it will be st and rho of x, st. And usually they go together, sort of the amoeba and the Rankine function. It's called the Rankine function of the amoeba, or of the curve. So this thing is the base for the three-dimensional base for the Calabi-Yau.
So that curve looking just like this Hari Vatnamira.
Pardon?
This amoeba that you write down seems to be this Hari Vatnamira, I guess.
Yeah.
And this was discovered independently of what you were saying about some combinatorial description.
Combinatorial, when I said combinatorial development and mirror symmetry, I just quoted certain discussions. There was a conference in Palo Alto in October on real algebraic geometry, and there were some nice ideas sort of floating around about possible generalization of mirror symmetry to the just simply to asymptotical families of Riemannian manifolds. And these integrals, in general, they appear in many asymptotical problems. In particular, if you consider the growing family of these three-dimensional Calabi-Yau Riemannian manifolds, the asymptotics of metrics, certain parts of them can be expressed in terms of amoebas. So it's just a technical tool that is useful to know. This is what I meant to say.
You just mean large volume?
Hmm?
When you say asymptotic, you just mean large volume?
Large volume, yes.
What do mathematicians make out of this sort of quantized, the other limit?
Which one?
Well, when you're not at large mass.
Oh, when you have this
discrete nature.
Well, I don't know what to say. It's sort of technically speaking, how do you prove this statement for toric Calabi-Yaus? The idea is that you can compute these numbers. These numbers, as I wrote, they are integrals of certain volumes of certain moduli spaces. So when the variety is toric, then you can compute these volumes just by counting the points in the Newton polytope with certain weights. This is the standard thing to do. And that's essentially how they computed, and this is how this conjecture was proven for these toric varieties. And then when you start to count these points, it just happens that this count is exactly sort of the count of the random 3D partitions with certain weights. And for this particular case, when you consider the neighborhood of a vertex in the Newton polytope, in this case, the counting is equivalent to this distribution Q to the volume. It's actually, from what I understand from Okunkov, it's not true that for any Calabi-Yaus you will get this dimer configurations. It's a characteristic feature of this of the neighborhood of a vertex. For others, you have some other measures on 3D on plane partitions, and it's yet to be understood what they are. Possible that because you glue this local Calabi-Yaus from the pieces corresponding to the corners, so some of these corners start to interact. It's possible that the free fermions that correspond to the corners, now they sort of, when you glue them together, they start to interact. So it's possible that the measures that you will have will be measures corresponding to the interacting fermions.
Q is e to the string coupling.
Yeah.
Or it's not the string coupling.
No, Q is e to the
string. Greater one of these boxes, so e to the string coupling.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what do you get if you expand the string coupling?
Oh, you will get Gromov-Witt invariance, according to this conjecture.
But none of these things converge.
No, these are all formal power series. In the cases when you can compute them, you know that it's either a rational function of Q or it's a convergent product. Why it's convergent? Well, why it's convergent is rather.
Because all versions converge.
Yes. Yet. Well, it's a fact. Yeah. Yeah, it's a fact when you have it a priori, I don't know.
For the questions, let's thank our speakers.